Okay, well, thank you guys all so much for coming out on a rainy morning. I don't know that I would have come out to see me in this weather, so I appreciate you guys taking the time to do so. So the first talk I'm going to give this morning is titled A Nation of Settlers. And I actually, if somebody could grab me a copy of my book, just maybe from the table. So that's going to talk about immigration in that context. And then the second talk I'm going to have, for those of you who've been to all of the different talks I gave yesterday, we'll kind of be wrapping up and saying, okay, Jeremy, all this stuff is going on, so you know why and what do we do about it? So that's kind of the order of operations today. So I'm going to start, this is the Chinese famous military strategist, even in the West now, Sun Tzu, talks about every battle being won before it's even fought. And I think that's really important in this case, and in particularly when we talk about immigration, because a lot of times, and we have this problem on the right in general, and I think as Christians in general, that the rhetorical ground on which we fight battles, we've often lost it before we even show up at the battlefield, as we end up kind of fighting on the enemy's terrain under the enemy's rules. So I'm going to try in this talk to kind of disrupt that type of thinking and to show a different way of kind of going about things. So I'm going to start out with this, and this is the only one of these talks that I've even ever given a version of before. So I've actually talked about this in some other places. This is I saw this on t-shirts. And actually, the interesting thing, and I'll share this only because this is a Montana audience, the thing that motivated me, and I write about this in the book, although I don't identify the place, I saw this shirt in Browning, Montana. And it's not the only time I'd seen it, but that was the thing that when I was writing this book, I was like, that is an anecdote that I'm going to run with. And I think it says something really interesting. And again, I'm just going to open up to my immigration chapter here, and I will read a little bit from that and kind of give you a sense of what I think the significance is. While history tells the story of America's past, no subject is as central to America's future, and no subject gets to the heart of the racism of our current anti-white regime more than immigration policy. As a result, few subjects are as riddled with taboos in their public discussion. What will happen when the ethnic composition of large parts of America is transformed in ways that America's European founders could never have foreseen? And in the interim, what will happen to whites as they continue to lose political power amidst their shrinking proportion of the population and as anti-white rhetoric and actions accelerate? Whether or not you believe that demography is destiny, these fundamental demographic questions cannot simply be papered over with happy talk. The reality is that the white population and thus the white voting share of the population is rapidly diminishing. The fact that whites are under such a sustained attack with our current white voting supermajority does not inspire confidence in how society is likely to treat whites when they are a much diminished minority. There is a t-shirt popular in Indian country and on some left-wing college campuses. It comes in several versions, but the most popular one has several Native Americans in traditional dress hoisting rifles while looking sternly at the camera. Homeland Security, fighting illegal immigration since 1492, it reads below. Another version with the same picture says, in quotes, "We should have built a wall." I chuckled, as some of you guys just did, the first time I saw one of these shirts. It's a clever slogan on its own term, and it makes the point that Native Americans, of course, were here when the first white settlers arrived. But upon further thought, I realized the statement it made was profound. It just cut in the opposite direction of the way it was intended. First, there are cultural ironies. The rifles the natives hoisted were, of course, not a Native American invention, but a very valued item obtained in trade with whites, a product of European civilization. Ditto the camera that took their picture and any number of other associated items. The effect would be similar to a t-shirt with whites planting corn telling Native Americans to, in quotes, get their own crops to plant. But more profoundly, while Native Americans have arguably benefited from joining the most globe-spanning power that has ever existed, they also paid a heavy price. Today, there are almost 10 million self-identified Native Americans in the United States, as well as millions of other white-identified Americans with at least some Native American ancestry. But Native Americans learned, much to their regret, the consequences of their failure to protect their border, their language, and their culture. Their failure to do so should cause whites to redouble their efforts not to make the same mistake. Indeed, in some important ways, the current treatment of whites in America parallels the treatment of Native Americans. Of course, whites haven't suffered anywhere near the level of population or cultural loss that Native Americans did, yet. But while there were crimes committed on both sides of the white Native American struggle, some of the early treatment of Native Americans, though we now see it as in part misguided, was a genuine attempt at acting for their benefit. The first successful permanent settlement in the United States, Jamestown, had one of its principal goals, if not the principal goal, the Christianizing of Native Americans, a task which most Bible-believing Christians would endorse to this day, despite the many failures and tragedies that occurred along the way. Reservations, while the subject of numerous broken promises and policy failures, were a way to give tribes sovereignty and autonomy over some territory. The recent Supreme Court decision to hand over political jurisdiction over much of eastern Oklahoma to the Cherokee, though narrowed in a subsequent decision, suggests these rights are still taken seriously. Given the tribes' often brutal treatment of each other and their treatment of white captives, it is difficult to argue that, had Native Americans triumphed, whites would have been treated better than natives have been treated under a white dominant regime. So that's how I actually start my chapter on immigration. And as I said, this was inspired directly by this t-shirt I saw in a store in Browning when I was on my way to Glacier National Park. And I do think it's kind of a, just an interesting thought experiment as we kind of think about the immigration issue. So the first point I want to make here is that settlement and immigration, this is why I call this talk A Nation of Settlers, are not at all the same thing. So settlement is really what describes what happened in early America. It's a something where you're going and you're setting up a new civilization. You're not joining an existing political community. Now, of course, this is not a way, I'm not attempting to erase the clear Native history that existed here, but the whites who immigrated here were not looking to join the Native American political community. They were looking to create their own political community here and social community. And settlement is inherently, especially back then, just an enormously high-risk endeavor. So I've just listed three things up here to kind of give you an example. I grew up in North Carolina, as I think I mentioned yesterday. The Lost Colony was very famous where I was from because that actually happened in North Carolina. 1587, this was the first attempt at European settlement in the United States. 100% mortality. Nobody knows to this day what happened to them for sure. Almost certainly they were massacred by the local Croatan tribe, but we don't have any direct archaeological evidence to support that. All we know is they were settled, the various things happened for a couple years. The first European, or rather the first English baby, Virginia Dare, was born in America to that colony, and then 3 years later when their much delayed supply ship showed up, everybody was gone. So very risky. Jamestown, which I just alluded to, not even necessarily fully successful because ultimately it was abandoned after many years, but it was sort of the mother colony of things that became successful. 1607, 90% mortality of some of the early settlements. There was the original winter, the starving time, not the original, it was the second or third winter, I think. And they just, cannibalism, I mean, it's really it's some of the most horrific stuff that you could imagine combined with native attacks and everything else. Pilgrims, 1620, of course, everybody knows who they are. Thanksgiving, 50% mortality the first women of the winter alone. So this is what they are expressing thankfulness for, that they could survive this enormously high-risk endeavor. Now, that is a totally different type of thing. I just kind of pulled this over. This is a, you know, ultimate home buying a home for new immigrants, then immigration today. Even if you're going across the border illegally, which is not a zero-risk proposition, obviously, the type of risk that you are taking on as an immigrant today is, it's not even in the same world as the sort of risk and change that the settlers were taking in early America. And so I think it's just sort of useful to start out, this is why I talk about the importance of kind of discussing the ground in a useful way, that these are just very different phenomena entirely. So here's some selected quotes of the founders talking about immigration. So George Washington says, "By intermixture with our people, they or their descendants get assimilated to our customs, measures, and laws. In a word, soon become one people." This is kind of really the melting pot idea before the melting pot is a specific phrase that comes out of a British playwright, actually, named Israel Zangwill in the late 19th century. But here's George Washington basically expressing a very similar sentiment in the 18th century. So not kind of a radical departure. We have Alexander Hamilton. He now famous for the musical and the currency. The United States already felt the evils of incorporating a large number of foreigners into their national mass. It has served very much to divide the community and distract our councils. Important to note here that Hamilton himself was an immigrant. But you know, his point here was, I think, a very important one as we kind of talk about immigration, which is scale matters a great deal. So that's why one of the most prominent kind of restrictionist policy organizations is called Numbers USA. Because you can have the most fantastic, productive, wonderful immigrants who kind of individually add a great deal to the political community. But if that quantity of people is like 70% of your existing political community, you're gonna have a profound social transformation that people may not have signed up for as a result of that type of immigration. So finally, I've got a quote from James Madison, and those who acquire the rights of citizenship without adding to the strength and wealth of the community are not people we are in want of. And so here, Madison is making the point that, again, gets lost. This is where I talk about, again, the importance of fighting these sorts of fights on our terrain, not their terrain. Immigration is in the interest of the American people. That's what it has to be. That is the only correct, I would argue, way to which to view immigration. This is not a humanitarian thing. It's not a charity. It's not any of those things. It is what serves the just interest of the American people who are here right now, who are American citizens. That's what should be the determinant of our immigration policy. And again, I think we and Christians as a whole and the right and whoever get very fuzzy on that point. Now, I could also share a lot more thoughts on immigration. If you go back and you read the 1790 congressional debates on the naturalization law, which was the kind of first time that we really addressed this as in a very concrete way, there's all sorts of fascinating stuff. You probably only do that if you're somebody like me. This is kind of your job, but it is interesting things if you're sort of interested in understanding how our founders thought about immigration. So even the far left here gets something right. And I'm now quoting, and this is actually, it's interesting because this far left academic, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, makes a claim, and it's actually very similar to my claim from a factual basis. It's called Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and History of Erasure and Exclusion. Now, the editorializing, I obviously don't agree with, but the fact that she's drawing this distinction between settler and immigrant, I actually agree with her. It's really important, and it's important in terms of how we think about this issue. And again, I'm quoting from her book. During the nearly two centuries of British colonization up to US independence, the great majority of European settlers were Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, and Scots-Irish. If you guys were here yesterday, I showed some of that slide talking about the demographics of the US in terms of the founding. And I mean, it wouldn't even be correct to think of it, and they wouldn't have even conceptualized it, quite frankly, for the most part. I mean, there are things about free white citizens in the original Naturalization Act, but it wouldn't have even been conceived of white. It was British versus everybody else. And then if you want to get really specific, there were sub-distinctions within British that mattered a lot. And there's a really great book called Albion's Seed by David Hackett Fisher that's it's like super, super thick, heavy, intimidating read, but it kind of talks about the different British cultures and where they settled in different parts of America and how it affects American culture today. If anybody's interested in a really serious kind of understanding of American folkways, I'd highly recommend that. But I think to kind of return specifically to the immigration issue, this is something that the far left and I are in agreement about, a kind of fundamental element, that we weren't really a nation of immigrants. And I'll talk about that mythology as we go forward. So most of the American history is a history of settlement and not immigration. And again, I'm just quoting from a writer. So this is a reference to Alexis de Tocqueville. for those of you who kind of took government at a serious level, or if you went to a more in college, or if you went to a more rigorous high school, you might have been even exposed to him in high school, or perhaps as an adult. Alexis de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America, probably the most famous book ever written about American politics, most important book. He wrote it in the 1832, I think. He was a Frenchman and a conservative. Like, it's not the core thing to understand about when you read him, but he was a big champion of generally the American experiment, although not an uncritical one. And he wrote this book, Democracy in America, which is still read by people interested in political theory for the sorts of insights that it gave about American politics. And the interesting thing about Democracy in America, and again, this is written in 1830, 1832, is that the word immigrant or immigration is not mentioned even once in this book. And this is a really interesting fact. And in fact, it's so interesting that there are a couple of de Tocqueville scholars who have commented on this fact. And so why is that? Why could he go to this country that's such a new country that is a bunch of European descended people who none of them were there a couple centuries before and not even mention the word immigration or the concept of immigration? Well, in the 1830s, we were sort of after the initial colonization rush, the initial post-independence, more people moved here. Our immigrant population was something like 2 or 3% of the country at that point. It was very small. And so the point is, at some point, at times we've had a lot of immigration, and immigration of various types has been really important to the US. But at other times, immigration was a really marginal factor. And so it was that you could have this thing, and we are closer to Alexis de Tocqueville in time than he was to the original European colonists who settled here. But he doesn't even see migration as relevant enough to mention in his book about American folkways. The most classic book ever written about American politics. So just sort of something interesting. And again, this is a writer on de Tocqueville saying the initial groups that had come to America two centuries before were conceived of as pilgrims, colonists, or settlers, but not as immigrants per se. So you could call these pilgrims, colonists. I'm choosing the term settlers. It's a little bit provocative. I'm being a little nerdy and academic because that will really annoy the academic left because they love to talk about settler colonialism as an evil thing. And I'm like, yeah, they were settlers. What about it? But you could equally call them pilgrims, colonists, pioneers, whatever they were. Very different than what we have today. So let me talk a little bit about historical patterns of American settlement and immigration. So this is my own taxonomy here. It's not some sort of universal thing that every scholar has agreed on, although I think that few would sort of dispute the general outlines. But it's just a way to think about things. So from 1607, which is Jamestown, to 1776, you have what I call the British settlement era. We're not an independent country yet. We have settlers coming from throughout Europe, particularly Western and Northern Europe, but overwhelmingly British. At Independence Eve, as best we can tell, we were about 85% British. Maybe that's a little high, but like ballpark. So that's what I call it. We're still under British sovereignty as well. Then 1776 to 1848, we have what's called the American settlement era. Immigrants and settlers at this point are still mostly of British origin, okay, if you kind of go back and look. And then in 1848, something changes. Can I put anybody on the spot? Anybody know what happens in Europe at 1848? So 1848, you have what are called the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. Huge amount of political ferment, monarchies being overthrown, monarchies trying to be overthrown, all sorts of revolutionary movements. Most of them end up failing, and you get a lot of political refugees from places like Central Europe to the US at scale for the first time. But again, mostly from Northwest Europe, but still you begin to get Central Europeans. Some of my family came over from Central Europe at this time. The other major thing that happens right around this time in 1848 is the Irish potato famine. And that brings a huge number of Irish immigrants to the United States for the first time. So we go through that. Then we get to 1891. And I would argue in 1891, that's the first time you can really refer to America as a nation of immigrants for any period of time. And this is just for this small era, 1891 to 1924. So that's 270 years post-settlement. This is the first time we really begin to get massive numbers of immigrants from other parts of Europe, primarily. We also begin to get a few immigrants from Asia at this point. Actually, we get some of them before that, but we begin to get them increasing numbers at this point. But we really begin to get larger numbers of people from pretty foreign cultures by American standards showing up at our door. And it is not a coincidence that as a result of three decades of that, we begin to get the first real anti-immigrant movements in the United States, because before it was kind of co-ethnics. It was people who people shared a little bit more of a culture with, they shared a language with in many cases. And in 1924, you get a immigration law that is the strictest immigration law that has ever been passed in United States history. And without kind of getting into all the details of what it did, it basically shuts down immigration, and it dramatically lowers the numbers and attempts to explicitly preserve the existing ethnic balance, I think as of the 1880 census of the country in terms of how it's organized. So that's what that does, and that leads to a 41-year period, which I call a nation of no immigrants. This is an exaggeration. There were still immigrants coming at that time, but the flows are dramatically paused. People are like, whoa, let's settle down, let's reconstitute, like, who the heck are we? I would argue that it is not a coincidence that in the wake of this and in the wake of World War II, which is a hugely homogenizing, and I mean that in a good sense, thing for the U.S. I mean, it obviously had a number of other consequences, but it threw a bunch of people from different parts of the U.S., different backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds together in a common project. I don't think it's a coincidence that in the wake of all this, you get the 1950s, which are almost the sort of stereotypical, you know, kind of made fun of all-American environment that we have. And that was because we shut the door on immigration for a while, and we said we're going to assimilate the people we have and figure out what this new American culture is going to look like. And we're going to make it based on the existing culture as much as we can that was already here. And of course, these new groups are going to inevitably bring their own pieces to the mix, their own cultural pieces to the mix. But that's what they're sort of doing. So we go through a 40-plus year period of that. And then this gets very contested. And from 1965 on, we pass the Hartzeller Immigration Act. I referred to this briefly yesterday. That's named after its sponsors in the House and Senate. And this is the thing that just dramatically changes American immigration law. We currently live under the Hartzeller regime. It's, you know, it's totally unprecedented what happened, and it was a result of this Hartzeller bill in 1965. And again, that's a universally, like, if you had a far leftist atheist here, he would say the same thing about Hartzeller. So that's not a controversial point. The only question is whether it's a good thing or not. So U.S. immigration, this is kind of a little bit of a restating of my point that I just gave, but it's now graphical, has increased dramatically in volume and changed radically in origins. So again, if you go back now keep in mind, this graph actually starts on the left-hand side in 1820. So we've left off the first 200 years where really there was almost nothing that I would call immigration, but even so, you can see the numbers are very small. Again, in the late 1840s, you see that big first peak. That's the 1848 revolution and immigrants coming from Central Europe and also the Irish potato famine. Then you begin to get these sort of bouncy effects from various things going on. You get this huge, so that's sort of all Northern and Western Europe, and I think this graph correctly calls it frontier expansion era. Then we go into the industrialization era. That's another thing to keep in mind. I mean, just like today, a lot of these immigrants were not particularly highly skilled when they're coming here. But then we were a nation that up until 1890 is still expanding on its western frontier, so there's farmland open. We are a nation, and of course Montana has its own story there, that is industrializing and becoming the biggest industrial power, so we need a lot of kind of manufacturing, people who can do manufacturing and kind of be in factories. So a very different world economically than what we're in today. So then you get this sort of Southern and Eastern Europe for the first time. significantly under under the starting in the 1890s. Then you get this slamming on the brakes in 1924. You can kind of see it. It goes down to a pretty significant trough. It begins to climb even before Hartzeller. But it's still primarily Western Europe. That's the source, okay? And that's because we've changed the immigration laws at this point. Then, in 64, you get Hartzeller. And unfortunately, the only bad thing about this graph is that it stops in 2012. I show it just because I think it's a really nice visualization of, explains a lot of different things about immigration in America in one graph. But if we could show the number of immigrants, particularly since Biden, it'd be off the chart here to the right. I mean, it's just like, it's super high. The numbers of unauthorized immigrants, it mentions here, it's a peak, or illegal immigrants. Biden has blown through that dramatically. I think there's something on the order of 6 million that he's brought in just in 3 years. So this is not just kind of more of the same. It's a really pretty dramatic transformation. So now I'm going to go back and kind of fill in some of the details here of American immigration. So in 1890, something really important happens. America's frontier closes. That's, again, not just an opinion thing for me. This is the U.S. Census Bureau comes out and says the frontier is closed. But what they meant is that everywhere in America had kind of had at least some settlement by their metrics. Now, this is kind of an interesting point, especially to say so close to eastern Montana, because a lot of this settlement was still very, very thin. It was still very pioneering, especially if you're out in places like eastern Montana. A huge percentage of it, particularly here, failed, right? Like, you go out, eastern Montana was more populous in 1910 than it is today, right? So it was a hard existence still for a lot of people, but we kind of filled in the frontier. So that's a big change in American history. It's also, I would argue, a big change in how we should think about immigration at that point. And the quote I have here is from a historian named Frederick Jackson Turner. Frederick Jackson Turner was at Harvard. He was this kind of premier American historian of the late 19th century. He's actually still a wonderful person to read, even if some of his stuff is out of date. I would always recommend it. And he writes this really important book, and it's based on a speech he gives at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. It's called The Significance of the Frontier in American History. And he talks about how this notion of the frontier was so vital in terms of how America saw itself as a country and the sorts of needs that we had as a country. And now it's closed, and he makes this statement. He says, the frontier is gone, and with it going has closed the first era of American history. So it's a really profound change. It's a change that I think has a lot of effect about how we saw immigration then back then is like now we have different needs as a country. We're not just expanding ever outward, and we have a different society. And people have, even today, historians are always writing about this frontier thesis because you can talk about it not just in terms of American history, but in terms of all sorts of other histories. It's a really profound thesis. Turner's a really great writer, well worth reading. So the other thing that happens at roughly the same time that this is going on is the frontier is closing and the Statue of Liberty is rising. They're not quite at the same time. I think the Statue of Liberty is 1884, but roughly sort of the same era. So it was not built as a symbol of immigration. It was built as a monument to Franco-American friendship. It was built to celebrate U.S. democracy. It was built to celebrate the end of slavery in the United States. It had nothing to do with immigration. Except this, and this is this woman, Emma Lazarus, who probably some of you know because of her poem. And Emma Lazarus, actually, let me just go back to this. So she is sort of an interesting figure. She was kind of a very upper-class Jewish woman who is actually descended from the kind of Jewish equivalent of the Mayflower, which were the first boat from Amsterdam in 1653, that had arrived with Jewish immigrants to the United States. And so she was very much this high society New York person. She wasn't one of these kind of like huddled masses that she talks about in her poem, which we would associate with like the immigrants from Eastern Europe of all types or Southern Europe. She herself is a member of New York's high society. And in fact, she's really good friends with a woman named Philippa Schuyler. And if any of you have seen or read Hamilton, the musical, this is the Schuyler family that is the direct descendants of Alexander Hamilton, and Alexander Hamilton himself marries one of the Schuyler sisters. So she writes this poem, The New Colossus, which is now inscribed on the statue's base, because she's sort of seeing all these immigrants coming in, and she's sort of inspired by these people who are fleeing persecution in various parts of Europe. Some of them are co-ethnics, some of them just, you know, people coming from other parts of Europe. She dies a year or two later. She wrote this poem to, like, raise money for the statue's base, because there was big fundraising that had to happen to get the Statue of Liberty going. It's sort of forgotten, and then she kind of dies unexpectedly at a fairly young age, and her friend Schuyler starts a fundraising campaign to memorialize her through putting this poem on the statue's base. And that's how we got the modern definition of the Statue of Liberty, because Schuyler is ultimately successful in this. She puts it on. This is right at the time we begin to have really, really massive immigration into Ellis Island, and it changes the public meaning, at least in the left's mind, of what the Statue of Liberty is all about, what it signifies. I've got a Nancy Pelosi Statue of Liberty there, but kind of get the point. So you still have this. You have a lot of left-wing ethnic activists who create Hart's Cellar. So this was really a product of Jewish and Catholic ethnic activism. This is our current immigration regime in the early 1960s. So John F. Kennedy is not president yet in the late 1950s. He wants to run for president. There's a lot of unhappiness, particularly in some of these urban areas, about American immigration policy because people can't get their families to come over or whatever have you. So Kennedy writes this book in conjunction with the Anti-Defamation League, which is the major Jewish civil rights organization in the country, and with the support of some key Italian-American groups, essentially a lot of Catholic urban constituencies that were not favored by the current immigration law. And he writes this Nation of Immigrants book. And it is designed as essentially to help his presidential campaign, because he figures out to win these swing states in the Midwest, I want to kind of be ultra pro-immigration. That's what's going to help me. And so he creates this mythology, and what I've tried to explode that mythology in the first several slides I give, that America was and is a nation of immigrants. And what I've tried to show is that's really not true. I mean, at times it has been. There have been times of big immigration. There have been times of small immigration. At the time in which John F. Kennedy wrote this, it was particularly untrue. It was really, we could not have been less of a nation of immigrants. Our immigrant population at this point is about 4.7%. To give you a comparison, it's 15.5% now. And those immigrants at this point are vastly disproportionately elderly. They're people who often came before the 1924 Restriction Act, and they're kind of well assimilated into American culture. So at the time in which a nation of immigrants ideology is being created, we're actually not a nation of immigrants at all. So Democrat politicians lied about Hart-Celler's effects, okay? So I'm just going to pick a couple of quotes here. This is President Johnson signing the Hart-Celler Bill in 1965. He says, "This bill we signed today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives." Senator Ted Kennedy, the president. So, you know, of course, at this point, John F. Kennedy has been assassinated. I don't think, just like some of the civil rights law, I don't think Hart-Celler would have gotten through had Kennedy not been assassinated. This gets through after the Lyndon Johnson landslide in the wake of Kennedy's assassination. But it does, finally, in 1965. Ted Kennedy, his younger brother, who's now in the Senate, says this bill will not flood our cities with immigrants. It will not upset the ethnic mix of society. It will not relax the standard of admission. It will not cause American workers to lose their jobs. Wrong, 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 and wrong, right? Not surprisingly, unfortunately. I think there is something to be said for the fact that a lot of these folks who did Hart-Celler actually didn't know exactly what they were signing up for. In fact, I was able to go kind of do some original archival research for this book, and I found something in the New York Times from 1968, and it was sort of saying, whoa, you know, this is doing a whole bunch of stuff that we hadn't planned, because they thought they were sort of just doing family reunification for folks in Italy, to be able to come to the U.S. But he said, but now we don't want to touch it because we don't want to be called racists. So congressmen don't want to be called racists. So I think this is really interesting to show how anti-white racism has been used as a cudgel in these debates long preceding today. In 1968, a time in which you could make much better arguments that kind of white supremacy might have been an ongoing thing in a large part of America, people were scared to do anything that would look like they were advantaging the white community in any way. So that, I mean, that's a matter of public record. So Hartzeller was a demographic revolution. I showed this slide yesterday, so I won't belabor it, but you can just see here's the 1960 census. These Hispanic, Asian, and Black immigrant populations are really, really small. Now in the wake of that, this is just a fundamental demographic transformation of the country. So really big deal. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about a biblical view of immigration. So I'm going to sort of switch from kind of explaining how we got there to kind of talking a little bit, and this is, again, not definitive. I cannot stress enough, I'm not a biblical scholar, but these are some things that I've picked up as I've looked at this. Jim Hoffmeyer is a particularly an Old Testament scholar. He's written a really good book that I'm going to talk about, and also Marcus Zender. So if you're interested in kind of a biblical perspective on the immigration issue, these are a couple of good resources to start. Migration and Christian nationalism. I want to talk about this before I get into some of the details. We shouldn't oppress the stranger, but getting taken advantage of, I would also argue, is not Christian. And a lot of, there's a typo here, but a lot of churches have gone very weak on the question of Christian nationalism. This is a book from my friend Stephen Wolfe called The Case for Christian Nationalism. I don't have time to get in. Some of you guys may be involved in this Christian nationalism debate. This is a debate I could take up two lectures just talking about this. I just want to flag it very briefly because at its most abstract, at least a significant part of the debate is to say that even it's not just necessarily just Christian, but it's Christians that share a certain culture, and that culture matters when you talk about Christian religion and creating a Christian community, and that it's not just sort of some abstract thing. And in fact, of course, as Christians, we realize that when we missionize, because when we go out into the mission field, if we go to Burkina Faso, we're not just going to go with the same culture and expectations that we have in America, because we're not going to make converts that way. Okay, we need to meet them where their culture is, and this is true wherever we go. So it's simply, Wolf is arguing in this book that Christianity is fundamentally a religion, but it also has, in American context, this really important cultural component. So again, this is a horrific compression of a really, really complicated debate on Christian nationalism. We've done it at Claremont. I participated in a series about Christian nationalism. You can go on our website and read it, but I did want to just at least flag that because I do think it's relevant for the migration debate. So Hoffmeyer on biblical immigration, just to talk about that a little bit. So the Old Testament Bible employs many different terms for migrants, and they've been translated into English in various ways. Sometimes they're sojourners, sometimes there are strangers, aliens, and foreigners. And he points out the duty to not oppress strangers, ger, found in Leviticus, does not apply unless a person has already gained legal approval to be within a nation's borders. So this is like a pretty important, like these different words that kind of get compressed into immigrant have very different meanings in a biblical context. And the legal status needed to be obtained from an appropriate authority in that particular culture, or else he or she remained a foreigner, a nekhar or a zar. So again, these are all different terms. There's another way of saying, Israel did not let random sojourners just become members of the Jewish people. Okay, like you had to, and this is not just true for them, I think it was particularly true for the Israelites, but you look at the book of Ruth, right, which is whither thou goest, I will go. I mean, but this whole thing about kind of having to get various approvals and some skepticism about letting new people join your community is deep within the biblical text. So again, Hoffmeyer goes into this all in his book. So on borders, biblical times have borders. See the Israelites fleeing Egypt. Permits akin to the modern visa were issued to people entering another land. And again, he gets in his book into a great deal of starting even in extra biblical times. So this was kind of a universal thing in the ancient Near East. Egyptian pharaohs were kind of issuing border passes and their border guards. And there was in no sense was it a borderless world. And he gives this very interesting thing. If you're a real Bible nerd, you're going to kind of know this passage. It's from Numbers 20:14 to 21. So the Israelites are trying to obtain permission from the kingdom of Edom in southern Jordan, and it wasn't granted. And so I'll just read the text. He says, Moses sent messengers from the king of Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. That's my emphasis. We will not pass through a field or vineyard or drink water from a well. We will go on the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or the left until we have passed through your territory. But Edom said to him, you will not pass through lest I come out with the sword against you. And the people of Israel said to him, we will go by the highway, and if we drink your water and my livestock, I will pay for it, but only pass through on foot and nothing more. And he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against them with a large army and a strong force. And thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. So it's not necessarily endorsing the actions of the Edomites here, but the point is that here is just in a very matter-of-fact way within the biblical text, it is taken for granted that if you are a group of foreigners coming into some other country, you need to get permission to be there, and that permission may not be granted. And they said, but despite politely seeking permission and offering to compensate the Edomites, they're refused, and Edom sends out the army. You know, they send out the border guards, and they're like, you're not going to come through our territory. The Israelites understood that foreigners needed to have an immigration permit to enter another land. So now let me talk a little bit about the biblical view of sanctuary cities, because this is kind of where the concept of a sanctuary city, and you know, we have these modern sanctuary cities, I think people are probably familiar with those in the American context. It says that they were specifically for if you killed somebody accidentally. So the ancient Near East, even like a lot of the modern Middle East, huge honor culture, deaths had to be avenged. A sanctuary city was not just like a place that you could hang out because you were doing stuff illegal. It's if you accidentally killed somebody, it was a place, Numbers 35:15, that you could flee to get a fair hearing, by the way, not to permanently evade the law. The cities of refuge were not a place to avoid trial or punishment. So, interestingly, Attorney General Sessions under Trump, who's very strong Christian and very biblically knowledgeable, he talks about this, and I've really compressed his talk, but he talked about it when he was in office. He said, I recall Nehemiah returning to Jerusalem. He went to build a wall in Jerusalem, and it wasn't to keep people in, you know. And in the story of Nehemiah, the cupbearer of the king of Persia, he gains leave to rebuild Jerusalem, and it's in disrepair, and cultural pollution is a big part of this, and ritual pollution. And it says, of their children, half spoke the language of Ashdod or one of the other peoples, and none of them knew how to speak the language of Judah. So this is seen in the biblical text as a big problem that needs to be cured. And so Nehemiah calls on his fellow Jews to rebuild the walls, as Jeff Sessions points out, so that we may, in quotes, no longer be a reproach. And then the wall is restored, the chosen people make a new covenant, assuring kind of ethnic endogamy, and that's the story. So you have this. And again, so these go back, and a lot of people in the policy debates don't read Numbers, you know, really deeply, but it is in the biblical text that it does talk about these issues. So evangelicals and immigration. There was a really good group, Evangelicals for Biblical Immigration. I don't think it's so active right now, but they opposed the so-called DACA immigration bill. They wrote a very nice open letter. They say, we find the Bible does not teach open borders, but a wise welcome. We are welcoming to the waffle foreigner who, like a convert, comes as a blessing. We also find Nehemiah building walls to protect citizens from harm. So they make a direct reference to this thing in Nehemiah. And I would argue that the Bible, again, envisions a world of beautiful and unique nations, they continued, not a stateless open society run by global oligarchs, which is increasingly kind of what we've become. So that's kind of, again, you can't do justice to this in an hour, but I've tried to at least give you an overview of maybe some ways to think about it. So concluding thoughts. We've got a legal right to our own borders and an immigration policy that serves the interests of our citizens. And again, if you get in an argument with somebody about immigration, the ground we fight on, to start out with my first slide, is important. You just need to make them fight on that ground. That is the right ground. It is what serves the interest, the just interests of the American people. Don't let them change it to something else. In America, I hope I've demonstrated here, how we've been doing it is not how it's always been. Like, the level of invasion, frankly, that we have going on is frankly unprecedented. And so don't let them gaslight you into thinking otherwise. Legal good, illegal bad is a losing frame to talk about it. Because even if you have legal immigration, you still have to talk about, well, what of that is that legal immigration serving the U.S. interests in terms of its volume, in terms of who we're bringing in? And by the way, sometimes it clearly is, but sometimes it's not. But I think sometimes we can fall too much into the trap of saying, you know, it's just bad because it's illegal. No, I mean, all immigration needs to be up for debate because it all affects our political community in some pretty profound ways. And then finally, legal or not, America's high immigration levels cannot remain if America wants to be a unified country. And that's really the kind of bottom line. It's why I've worked on this issue and why I think it's important, which is we need some sort of cultural retrenchment like we had after the 24 Act, where there was very little immigration, and essentially over a 40-year period, we reconstituted an American identity with the people who were there, right? Like, which who were some of them coming from different places. And we figure out, well, what does it mean to be American now? How can we be a unified country now? And so that's really the message I have for you today. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions in the remaining few minutes that we've got.
The mics. Ah, I couldn't see them. Thank you.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Jeremy, I apologize for my ignorance, but the Hart-Celler Act said specifically what?
I'm sorry. I sort of glossed over it. But essentially, what it does is we'd had very specific numerical and country quotas tied to the 1890 census previously. So the 1924 Act, it's called the Johnson-Reed Act, had sort of said, look, we value keeping America American, for lack of a better term. Hart-Celler, it does a lot of things, but the most important thing it does is it gets rid of that. And it prioritizes family reunification. And that leads to what you'll sometimes hear called as the anchor baby phenomenon. So a baby is born, and all of a sudden, the parents have a citizenship claim. Doesn't mean they're automatically citizens, but they have a claim, and then when they're citizens, their brother can make a claim. And so you begin to get what's called chain migration as a result of Hart-Celler. Now, it does a lot of other things as well, but I would say that's the most fundamental thing to understand about what Hart-Celler does. Thank you for asking that, because, you know, I spend all my time talking about this, and so sometimes I just skip over some fundamental things that I should make clear up front.
So with all the economic hardships on state governments and cities and whatever like this, that even Eric Adams of New York is claiming that they're going bankrupt because of this. Is there likely, where's that going? Is there going to be any backlash to the immigration because of the financial repercussions?
Well, I think you're already seeing that. And, you know, I should, as you said this and asked this very appropriate contemporary question, it reminded me, I should have stressed overall, my point in saying the importance of the ground we're fighting on, I didn't even wade into any of this current stuff because I think it's really important to understand the basis of our arguments first. I mean, it's like reading the Bible, right? Like, before you're going to go have Bible study or whatever. I think, you know, that's why I didn't touch as much on this. So let's talk about this contemporary issue. It is clearly hitting these blue states a lot. In Biden's dream world, he finds a way to just shovel enough money at them that they can, you know, build more shelters and do whatever else and solve the problem, right, without deporting anybody, because that's the last thing that Joe Biden wants to do. But it's really clear that this thing, by the way, people like me have been calling for red states to do this for a decade or more. So it's really frustrating that it's taken this long. This is the most effective strategy that I've ever seen us use on immigration. In fact, the one time Ron DeSantis flew 50 illegal immigrants to Martha's Vineyard, you would have thought that a biblical plague had come, right? So I think that this is really effective. I think Governor Abbott down in Texas and Governor DeSantis should keep the pressure on, keep doing. Although there is a school of thought that says, in fact, my friend Orrin McIntyre, really good conservative Christian podcaster at The Blaze, just put out something this morning saying, yeah, we've made our point. What we should just do is Ron DeSantis and Abbott should just be deporting these guys to Mexico and dare Joe Biden to stop them, you know, because Biden can claim, well, you're intervening in a federal area. But the quick answer is there is an enormous amount of pressure on Biden. And it is indicative of just how utterly maniacal the Democrats have become on this issue, that despite the fact that this is an enormous political liability for him right now, to the point that it may cost him the election, he is not backtracked in any meaningful way. I would point out just parenthetically, and I'm thankful now that he's gone, but the only Mitch McConnell, through this disastrous failed immigration bill that he had, managed to muddy the waters on what was going on. And I grabbed Senator Daines beforehand and gave him an earful about this because I could see that this was gonna come. It was an utter disaster. But so the Democrats have been able to muddy the waters because Mitch McConnell misplayed this so much in the Senate. But the reality is it's a huge political loser for the Democrats right now because nobody likes what's happening. Even the so-called sanctuary cities are seeing the quality of life be vastly degraded.
Jeremy, it's me.
Yeah.
We had a conversation about Buchanan's book from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
He makes the case that the biggest change, one of the biggest changes that has been made in immigration policy is we used to have a policy that limited people from those nations where there was not a history of those people integrating into society.
Yeah.
The Mexican people, the Japanese people have not been great about integrating into our culture.
Yeah.
So, hello, multiculturalism.
Right.
Was Buchanan right or was Buchanan wrong?
I think like most things, he was primarily right. I'd have to go back and reread the particular book or the particular passage. But I mean, he was certainly right to be worried about these identity issues for many decades before any other prominent political figure on the right was really deeply worried about them. I do think just kind of indicative of the insanity here, just to, again, to give you a sense of, I hate to be so political and so polarized about it, but just the reality. We have what's called a diversity visa lottery in this country. Now, the very existence of this lottery is kind of insane because what it does is it gives around 55 to 60,000 visas a year. And the specific purpose of these visas is to have it come from countries with little ties to the United States historically. So it's like, we want to bring in a bunch of people who have no connection to America or Western culture. Like that's the purpose, the stated purpose of that visa. And when we looked and when we attempted to say, hey, at one point in an earlier immigration debate, one of the more dovish Republicans said, hey, we won't reduce the total number of visas, but let's swap out those diversity visas for high-skilled visas of like engineers and scientists and whatnot and people we'd like to have come here. We'll make you a one-for-one trade to do that. And then Democrats would not take it, would not do that deal. So I think that just kind of gives you a sense of where we are. And anything we do here is going to have to be done against the full strength of the Democrats. Anytime you hear anybody talking about a bipartisan immigration deal, you should reach for your gun. Because it's not going to happen. There is going to be, the only immigration deal worth doing is going to be done on a solely unipartisan way. I don't wish that. I think that's a big problem. I wish that weren't the case. Maybe in 3-4 years, the politics will have changed, but that's where we are right now.